Support for the World's Podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
Of Trump and toothpaste, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A sociologist from Turkey heads to a Trump rally and comes away impressed by his skills as a showman, but also worried about his brand of populist politics.
These are not things you kind of whip up and then, you know, after you get elected, you don't put the toothpaste back in the tube. It's a very dangerous moment.
And the face of Canada, according to its banknotes.
We have a number of Canadian prime ministers, you know, old, white, bald guys.
But that's about to change. And corruption scandals, Zika, will Brazil be ready to host this summer's Olympic Games?
Do not underestimate our capacity to throw a good party.
Those stories plus Fukushima 5 years on, today on The World. Glad you're with us on this Friday. We've got lots of great stories on tap today, including one about a 16-year-old Syrian filmmaker. We'll also take you up, down, and all around in South Sudan. But we start off the way everyone seems to be these days with the presidential race. We regularly hear from people outside the U.S. watching our election this year, and they say they're baffled by the language, the shouting, the personalities. So what happens when an academic who's originally from Turkey goes to a Donald Trump rally? Zeynep Tufekci is an associate professor at the University of North Carolina and someone we often speak with on the show about social media and its intersection with politics and society. So I asked Zeynep why she went to the rally in Fayetteville, North Carolina on Wednesday.
I was curious how it felt in the rally. I study social movements, and often what you see in the media reports after the event and how it feels on the ground is different. So I wanted to experience that on the ground. I also wanted to talk to people and see why they were there and how they felt. There's clearly a lot of support for his presidential campaign, and I wanted to hear from the people attending these rallies why they thought he should be the president.
All right. So let's say you kind of went as a social anthropologist, kind of. Is that fair?
Yes, I did. And also, I'm from a Muslim-majority country, and I'm an immigrant. And, you know, his campaign might deport me or not let me back in. So I thought I should get a sense of what's going on.
All right, let's get your kind of visceral reaction. Did you feel uncomfortable or threatened at all?
I did not, but, I mean, I don't have an immigrant from a majority Muslim country written on my forehead. I look like a white American, so
right.
That's partly why I could go and observe. I could just blend in.
So as somebody who looks at and studies social movements, what struck you about the social gathering that is a Donald Trump rally?
So it felt very much like a movement. It was very energetic. The people there clearly supported him. They were enthusiastic. And he was a very competent stage manager. It's just better than I thought he was at this craft. It's a craft. It's something you don't really feel on television, is that he had this command of the room and he was in touch with the mood.
So you spoke with some people. What did they tell you about why they were there?
One of the first things and the more common things I heard was nobody comes to Fayetteville. They thought that presidential campaigns just took them for granted and that nobody pays attention to them. In fact, the research shows this. The supporters seem to be animated by the sense that they don't have representation in government. Mm. It was largely a white crowd, not completely, but pretty overwhelmingly. And they were not sympathetic to the Democratic Party. But they also weren't sympathetic to the Republican Party. They didn't seem fond of the party either. And they just felt unrepresented.
Zeynep, as for the rally itself as a piece of political theater, did it remind you of anything you'd seen before? Or was it uniquely American?
It's not uniquely American. In fact, it's fairly common around the world. And you know, to give a Hitler example, it's actually one of the key elements of his rise was to organize these beer hall rallies, which he would make sure protesters showed up and then use the tensions and brawls with the protesters to enrage and energize his crowd and to stoke more resentment. So a lot of what we're seeing in the United States with this Trump's rise is something that's been happening around the world. There's a crisis of representation. And I study social movements, and I hear this from people across the political spectrum who say, I don't feel like politicians care or represent me or have my best interests in mind. And in the right-wing versions of it, it attaches to a politics of race and immigration and foreigners as the cause of these problems. And it's almost a textbook case of rise of an authoritarian populist movement.
So do you think Donald Trump could be president of the United States?
Actually, no.
And why not?
I concluded that from the rally, too. Even though he really clearly resonated with the crowd and knew how to stage manage the event and all of that, there was no discernible organization in the rally to try to have all these people who showed up, 12,000 people who showed up, to into some sort of voting organization. In other political rallies, what usually happens is there's merchandise sales are linked to donations, so they collect your information. Somebody goes around and they try to figure out where exactly you are. They try to turn the rally into the basis of a get-out-the-vote operation, at least recruit some people into it. It was nowhere to be seen. In fact, all the merchandise that were being sold right outside were peddlers, you know, street peddlers who had just shown up with their, you know, Trump T-shirts and buttons. And in fact, if the rally was 95% white, the people peddling the merchandise were 95% people of color.
Wow.
They were just poor people looking to make a little bit of money. And here was another crowd. And if they wanted red hats, they were going to sell them red hats. There was no Trump organization outside the rally at all.
What a detail.
The rally made me think this is a strong movement, and that's why it has potential. But the aftermath of the rally made me think, no, this is so dependent on one person's charismatic connection with a crowd. There's no organization behind it. So I don't think he's going to win the presidency.
Zeynep Tufekci, an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She was at the Donald Trump rally on Wednesday in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Thanks very much, Zeynep, for telling us about it.
Thank you.
Earlier this week, the New York Times published an aerial photo from South Sudan. In it, you see thousands of people in orderly lines against a sandy, dry ground. They look like a column of ants. These people were under the hot sun waiting hours for food. It hits home what's going on in South Sudan. Our partners at Frontline have taken visuals of this crisis even further. They've produced a virtual reality documentary about South Sudan's brutal civil war and the widespread famine that has shadowed it. Marcel Hopkins is part of the Frontline team behind the documentary. So tell us essentially what we see when we launch into this documentary. What's going on?
Well, we wanted to take people to South Sudan so that they could hear directly from the people who are experiencing this crisis. So the film opens in a village called Toch, which is in Jonglei State, and it's in one of the rebel-held areas of the country. And the Red Cross is delivering food there. And the village is on an island in a huge swamp, and so it's very difficult for planes to land there. So what they're doing is flying over and dropping food from the air. The first scene opens with that food drop. Viewers actually get to be in the middle of the drop zone as the bags of sorghum and beans and salt and sugar are falling on top of them into the swampy area.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary, this one part of it in particular. What does that do for the viewer, do you think? Is there any evidence that this heightens empathy for the people who are living this misery right now?
You know, that's an interesting question, and it's some that a lot of people are studying right now. Some people believe that virtual reality is the empathy machine and that it can heighten empathy for people who are experiencing it. There are several social science researchers who are working on that question right now, and I'm very eager to see actual scientific data about whether that is happening or not.
I would say if there's a story that could really benefit from virtual reality, it is famine, because it's such a difficult thing to capture, to document. Why tell the story of yet another famine, this one in South Sudan, whose evolution is pretty complex?
It is complex, and that is one of the main reasons why we wanted to tell this story. I grew up in the 1980s, and I learned about famine as a child through the famine in Ethiopia. And I was taught that famine is caused by a drought, and that it doesn't rain enough in Africa, and that this is a very sad situation, but that it's unavoidable because it's Mother Nature. What we learned in reporting on this crisis is that it's not a natural disaster, that is, it is entirely man-made, that this crisis is caused by people who have made decisions that have created the conditions that we're seeing today, which is a civil war that has displaced millions of people, has taken them away from their homes, from their farms, from their cattle. It has taken away their ability to feed themselves.
I've heard tales of single mothers who have to walk for miles with their children to get to these aid stations or the drop zone where the food is landing. How wide is the gap between the need and the aid that's available and getting in?
It's extremely wide. I mean, the international community is doing what it can to serve people there and to prevent people from starvation, but they have a lot of difficulty in reaching the people who are going hungry. There is an active civil war going on. There's active fighting. They are not able to get into some of the places with the highest need. When we were in South Sudan, we met a family on a tiny island in the middle of a swamp. They had just arrived there 2 days earlier. They left their village of Lir, which had been attacked, they said, by government soldiers, and the entire town had been burned down. All of their belongings that were not burned were taken. Their cattle were taken. They were forced out of their homes. They traveled 3 days through the swamp. They had one canoe for a family of 13. We met Peter Luak, who traveled with his 10 children, his wife, and her mother for 3 days through the swamp to get to this tiny island. When they arrived there, there were other families that had been sheltering there. And those families shared what little rations they had with them. Peter is a fisherman. He started weaving a fishing net so that he could go fishing to feed his family. They forage for wild plants, eat water lilies that are growing in the swamps. But the international community had not been able to reach the town that they came from because of the active fighting, and they had not yet reached this area of the swamp.
Marcel, tell us one story you really wanted to include in the documentary but were unable to because it didn't quite fit in. Was there one?
One of the stories that we did include was about a woman named Nyokos, and we've met her in Bentiu, which is the UN peacekeeping base. When we met her, she had just arrived to the camp. Her village had been attacked. The village was burned. Many of her neighbors and family members were killed. She was abducted by the militia and forced to move with them across the state as they continued on to attack and burn other villages. For 2 months, she was held essentially as a slave. So she had to cook for them. She had to fetch water for them. She said that they raped her repeatedly and they beat her. She escaped one night and spent 10 days walking to this UN camp to find safety. This entire time, she thought that her children, she has 6 children, she thought that her children had probably been killed in the attack on her village. When she arrived to this camp, she found all 6 of her children alive, including a 4-month-old baby. Her oldest daughter was 13 years old, and after the attack on the village, took her 5 younger siblings and walked by themselves for 7 days to get to this UN camp. They also thought that their mother had been killed, and she turns up at the camp 2 months later. And we met them, and we feature Nyokos and her family in the documentary.
Pretty miraculous story. I hope their luck continues. Marcel Hopkins with the frontline team that produced On the Brink of Famine. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
On the Brink of Famine was produced by Frontline and the Brown Institute for Media Innovation. We have that 360-degree experience at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. If a kid misses a few kindergarten classes, it seems pretty low stakes. No big deal, right? But there's research now showing a link between chronic absenteeism in elementary school and dropping out in high school. So there's a push to tackle it early on. Megan Burks of KPBS heads to one heavily immigrant school in San Diego that's trying to get young kids to school on time.
Good morning.
Good morning, Daddy.
It's 7 in the morning, and Crystal Ortega is waking up Aaron, her 5-year-old. They have 2 hours to get to school.
Good morning, sunshine.
Ortega tries to sound cheery, but lately it's been a struggle. The principal flagged her kids for showing up late too many times. But the principal's warning also comes with a helping hand. At Adams Elementary, where the boys go, a new program is matching chronically absent students with social workers who try to get to the bottom of what's keeping them from school. It's part of a nationwide push by United Way to tackle dropout rates, which are high among Latino families like this one. For the Ortegas, underlying problems include a marriage that ended and left Crystal Ortega with no car, one income, and a new home, a tiny trailer farther from school.
It was a cold part.
On icy mornings like this, the family's routine must go fast.
Get your backpack.
Once out the door, they walk to a bus stop a few blocks away. Their new home is 6 miles from school, but the maze of bus routes takes about an hour.
From home, we head on to the bus route number 3. From number 3, we catch either the orange line or the blue line to Civic Center. And then from there, we get the 215 rapid bus to 35th Street. And then 35th Street, we walk down to Adams School.
Mm-hmm. The final leg of the trip is familiar. The Ortegas walk through the neighborhood they once called home before the marriage ended. Ortega says she's tried to keep things consistent for her boys, but the instability makes it hard for them to get to school before the first bell. Aaron, in kindergarten, missed a few mornings as they learned the bus system. His older brother Nicholas missed classes too.
He went a little bit below basic. He has to turn in his homeworks on Fridays, and he wasn't here to turn that in.
But last October, things started turning around slowly. That's when the Ortegas showed up on Kelly Young's caseload. She's with United Way's Every Child, Every Day program at the elementary school. It's her job to intervene when the district flags students with attendance problems. Young connects those families, many immigrants, to services that might help.
Just basic things like issues of lack of food, housing, clean clothes, insurance, transportation, those can all be barriers for parents bringing their children to school.
Ortega says just having an ally like Young helps, showing her resources she didn't know about before.
I just wanted peace of mind and keep myself focused.
Shayna Gross is a senior vice president with United Way of San Diego. She's convinced that programs like this, working with young students and their parents, improves graduation rates. And those can be low among Latino students.
We know if kids aren't in school, then they can't learn. And if you're not reading at grade level by third grade, then you're 4 times less likely to graduate high school.
But Gross doesn't know yet whether the program is improving academic scores at the 5 schools where it's run. But she says 3/4 of the students in the program improved their attendance. In fact, Aaron Ortega, the kindergartner, got good news the other day.
All right, good morning, Adams Elementary.
That's the school's principal. She applauded the students, Aaron among them, who had perfect attendance that month. The reward? Extra recess. For The World, I'm Megan Burks, San Diego.
Because it's 2015, that was how Justin Trudeau answered a question when asked about gender equality and why it's so important to him. Pretty much how Canada's finance minister, Bill Morneau, put it early this week when he talked about the country's banknotes. I think it's high time to change, he said, referring to the absence of women on any banknotes in Canada except for their sovereign, Queen Elizabeth II. And now Trudeau has announced that Canadian women will be on the next series of bills. Of course, we've had our own version of this debate in the U.S. for a while now. So what have they been saying in Canada? Erin Conway-Smith is Canadian, and she's written about this for our Global Post team. I know you've got Queen Elizabeth II. What and who are some of the other things that are currently on Canadian banknotes, Erin?
Right. No, absolutely. Queen Elizabeth is on every one of our notes. But on the flip side of them, we have a number of Canadian prime ministers, you know, old, white, bald guys, basically.
And I got to say, I started thinking of who would be the Canadian women I would want to see on a banknote up there. And I had a hard time, partly because I don't know many Canadian women. I mean, Pamela Anderson seems an unlikely option. But I definitely vote to have Joni Mitchell or novelist Margaret Atwood on a banknote. Who are some of the women candidates?
Yeah, no, I think that those would be popular choices. But the thing is that the women candidates have to have been dead for at least 25 years. So that rules out a lot of the popular figures that you might have heard of.
So who are there any names that I might have heard of?
Sure. One, for example, that the a name that's being tossed around is an author named Lucy Maud Montgomery, who wrote a lot of books, but her most popular ones were about this redheaded young girl named Anne of Green Gables. I'm not sure if that got any popularity down in the U.S., but it's pretty big in Canada.
Mm. Anybody else?
Sure. And another woman, most Canadians would know her name from chocolate shops that you can find across Canada. Her name's Laura Secord. But in fact, she was a Canadian heroine of the War of 1812. And she alerted the British, obviously Canada was a British colony, that the Americans were coming to attack and thereby saved them. So she's another contender.
Wow. So Laura Secord, she's kind of like the Paul Revere of Canada.
Kind of, but kind of in reverse.
Right. Well, not alerting that the British were coming, but the Americans were coming.
Wow, exactly.
I did not know about that. How likely is it that this is going to happen? You think when Prime Minister Trudeau says it's going to happen, it will happen?
Yeah, I mean, they've put out an open call for nominations. So anybody in Canada can submit a nominee on the Bank of Canada's website. And they've laid out a process of kind of getting it down to a long list of names and then a short list. And then the plan is to have a woman as, you know, the prominent figure on a banknote to be issued in 2018.
I don't know how that compares to the U.S. plan for a release of a woman on a banknote, but do you think your people saw the debate going on here in the U.S. and said, we're going to beat the Americans to this?
We'd probably like to think that. I mean, I think it is just time. I mean, it is a bit ridiculous that it's not been the case already, that there is the woman prominently figured on a Canadian bill.
Erin, are you going to submit any names?
Well, based on the reaction on Twitter, it seems like a lot of Canadians have it covered. There's a lot of really active discussion going around, and some of the women that I'd like to see on bills, I think the names are already being put out there.
Like who?
For example, Emily Carr, the artist who painted scenes of the Pacific Northwest in Canada, in particular the Indigenous people there. And she also was a writer, wrote a beautiful book. And so I'd like to see her on a bill.
Well, I've learned a lot here today, mostly the names Lucy Maud Montgomery, Laura Secord, and Emily Carr. I really appreciate that. And that alone has been worth talking to you. Erin Conway-Smith of our team at Global Post, thanks so much. It was great.
Thanks, Marco.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A Syrian teenager dodged bullets in her hometown, then became a refugee. Now she's made a film to show what Western media get wrong about Syria. Her family thinks she's wasting her time making movies.
To them, what she's doing is not what she should be doing, which is, okay, study, then just get married, and that's about it.
That story coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. For the past 5 years, on my bedside table, I've had a copy of the New York Times with the bold headline, "Powerful quake and tsunami devastate northern Japan." Now, this was the edition of the paper on the day after the quake. Just below the photo, the paper mentioned that the nuclear plant at Fukushima had experienced a breakdown in the cooling systems and a warning that small amounts of radiation could leak from the plant. A week later, we learned that assessment was way off the mark. The quake led to a meltdown, the worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl. So today, how's the radiation? Not just in the waters off Fukushima, but also in the Pacific waters off Alaska, all the way down to Mexico. Ken Bissler is a radiochemist with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Last February, he measured the first Fukushima radiation to reach the shores of North America off of British Columbia.
So we did a dose assessment. If you get up every day, you go swimming in those waters for an entire year, you have additional dose. Now, turns out to be about 1,000 times smaller than a single dental x-ray. So I'm not concerned about swimming in the ocean or eating fish from our side of the Pacific.
Any concern that it could increase at this point, that we haven't seen the worst of it yet?
Well, you never know you're at the peak until you see it go down. The models predict somewhere around this year or next, it will start to decrease. it's actually important to realize there was already cesium-137 isotopes in the ocean before that accident. Everywhere in the world's ocean, Atlantic and Pacific, we have small amounts of these isotopes as residual leftover from the atomic testing done primarily in the 60s.
Now, you've also been studying the water near Fukushima since 2011. How much has radiation in the water off of the Japanese coast gone down since the initial meltdown?
Well, it decreased quite quickly, actually. April was actually the peak input into the ocean. All of that water used to cool the reactors was flowing directly in the ocean. That's when we saw 50 million of these units of becquerels per cubic meter. That's how we measure it. Mm. By the time we got there in June, we were in the thousands, and now it's down to a couple of hundred. So that's still elevated enough to still have to watch out for things like seafood consumption on that side near the reactor. Japanese have done a very good job, I think, of at least keeping the fisheries closed when the levels in the fish are above what they consider to be the threshold for human consumption.
Now, we're talking water here, but of course in Japan, they're also concerned about foodstuffs grown in the ground in the northeast part of the country still.
Right. Some products, things like mushrooms, pick that up more. They're doing testing. Almost all the food products from that region, Fukushima, are being tested for radioactivity to this day.
So after an event like this, what are the long-term ecological implications you expect from radiation in the water?
Well, in the ocean, we have now a level of cesium in the seafloor near Japan that continues to be a lingering source, but not levels that seem to be causing immense contamination. By that, I mean that 2011, over half of the fish in that area were above the seafood limits for Japan, and now it's less than 1%. Mm. But this residual is going to be here for decades to come.
Every disaster, sadly, is also a learning moment, we hope anyway. Fukushima, no exception. From an academic perspective, what is the most interesting thing you've learned in the past 5 years?
Well, in some ways, it's how little we know in our models of ocean currents and transport of contaminants. We had predictions ranging within a year of when this stuff would show up along the west coast, say, of the U.S. Now, when we're at the levels we're measuring today, that's not such a big deal. But if something were to happen today off Japan, you'd want to know 3 years from now whether that's going to arrive and what the concentrations are. So we're learning a bit about how weak, in some ways, our predictions can be. And in times of crisis, we need to do better than that. So I'm a little disappointed that our federal government hasn't followed up on this. So we've also kind of learned how we've had to go straight to the public and use crowdfunding as a way to get our support for the West Coast analyses.
What more would you like to see done?
Well, I think, you know, we have, say, EPA monitors air and drinking water. Why aren't we monitoring our oceans for radioactivity? That would give us a better baseline and just keep maintaining the cadre of people you kind of need to look at these environmental impacts. You know, whether you're for or against more nuclear power, we need to have people who can measure these contaminants in the ocean environment.
Ken Bissler with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, who's been studying the waters off of Fukushima and the U.S. West Coast since 2011. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
We're going to turn now to Syria, where a cessation of hostilities is technically in effect, though it does not cover groups like ISIS. The Russians have continued bombardment, and the U.S. coalition says they're going after ISIS targets. These coalition airstrikes have been going on since September of 2014, and they've also claimed civilian lives. The question is how many? The U.S. says 21 civilians have been killed, but one group says it's much more. It's crossed the threshold of 1,000. Richard Hall with our Global Post team is here in Boston, so I asked him about that group and how they got that grim number.
The number comes from a group called Air Wars, which is a team of investigative reporters who have experience in the Middle East, in the region. And what they do is they search for claims of civilian casualties, and they can get that information from social media, they can get it from local news reports, or they can get it from direct contributions from the public who have heard about these things, or witnesses even.
And Air Wars, do they have a political bent to their calculations?
They do not. Their history, it was started by a guy who had investigated the drone wars. So he investigated civilian casualties caused by drone strikes, U.S. drone strikes. So they have experience in this kind of field, and all the reporters they use have that sort of background.
So 21, so says the U.S., 1,000 says Air Wars. What number is correct?
I think the truth is closer to the Air Wars figure at 1,000. One of the reasons for this is that Air Wars doesn't really have a dog in this fight. The U.S. military, you can see, I mean, there are reasons why they'd want to downplay the number of civilian casualties for propaganda purposes, to give an impression that the war is going well. Air Wars doesn't have that motivation.
Mm. So those are the numbers. But, of course, behind every number is an actual person who's died. You've met the son of someone who was allegedly killed in a U.S. airstrike. Tell us about this young man and what he witnessed. What's his name?
That's right. You don't often get to hear the voices behind these numbers. This was a guy called Abdul Aziz Al-Hassan. His father, Ismail, was killed in a U.S. airstrike in Syria in a small village called Al-Gara. We visited him in a city called Adana in Turkey. We went to his house. It was down some narrow alleyways in a small two-room apartment. We sat down with him, and he spoke to us about what happened to his father and how he died. He's saying there was an airstrike in the middle of the village, and that's when my father died. And he went on to talk very emotionally about what his father meant to him and the weight of responsibility he now feels that his father is dead. His father was the head of the family. He was responsible for the immediate family and the dependents. And now Abdulaziz feels this weight of responsibility that his father once had.
So what has the death of the father meant for this son? I mean, what kind of sudden responsibilities has he taken on?
It's completely destroyed their lives. I mean, just speaking to him, you could tell that he was distraught. I mean, it was the family home that was destroyed. It was where they all lived, the extended family. And now he's living in Turkey. He's looking after 10 people, his own children, his extended family, and he's just distraught. And he was asking me, like, how am I supposed to rebuild my home? Is America going to pay for my home to be rebuilt? I mean, what's going to happen to me? He doesn't know himself.
Does he understand the need to kind of chase ISIS away from these areas that they currently hold?
It was interesting. He was telling us this was a village that didn't take any sides during the conflict. They weren't with ISIS. They were being attacked from all sides. First, the Free Syrian Army came along, then ISIS came along, then the Kurds came along, and then his house was bombed. So, I mean, what he said to me was that he was just tired. People were tired of this war. They were tired of being caught up in it, and he just wanted it to stop.
Since we were just talking about numbers, let me just ask you quickly. We know for sure that his father was, in fact, killed in a U.S. or coalition strike?
Yeah. So the reason we know this is because the Kurdish forces were launching an offensive on the village where his father lived, and the Kurds were being backed up by U.S. airstrikes at the time. And right. they admit that that's not controversial at all.
I mean, regardless of the exact number, do you think, Richard, that it's just inevitable that as long as these airstrikes go on, more people are going to experience the exact same things that Abdulaziz is having to deal with now?
Of course. I mean, you can have the most technically advanced equipment in the world. I mean, the U.S. military does have that. But you're conducting airstrikes in an area where you don't have allies on the ground. You're going to kill civilians, and that's just a fact of war.
Richard Hall with our Global Post team, who's been reality checking the civilian casualties in the bombing campaign in Syria. Thank you very much, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
So every one of those casualty numbers is a person, and everyone who's directly affected by the war in Syria has a story, but most don't get to share theirs with a large audience. We're going to hear another of those stories now, as told by a 16-year-old Syrian girl, Wala al-Alawi. That's not her real name. Wala is in Jordan now. After attending a workshop led by an American filmmaker, Wala made a short autobiographical film of her own titled The Girl Whose Shadow Reflects the Moon, just 5 minutes long. It's impressionistic and magical. Wala's narration is youthful and tender, but also world-weary for a girl of 16. Wala takes you through events from her past that no one, much less a seventh grader, should have to witness, like when she was walking home from school in her hometown of Dara with two friends. As usual, Wala says she was in the middle because she was the tallest.
I could hear something. Psst. My friend fell to the ground. The gunshot went through her head. My other friend, a gunshot went through her back, and she fell. I stood there from shock. All I could think of is, how can a shot go through like that? My friend was saying, Wala, I don't want to die. I'm still young. This moment in my entire life, I will never forget it.
Wala produced The Girl Whose Shadow Reflects the Moon after learning the basics of video production in a 6-week workshop with American filmmaker Laura Doggett. Laura wanted to teach the young Syrian refugees in Jordan how to tell their own stories on video after hearing them complain that media coverage by Western reporters didn't capture their reality.
The girls themselves felt that the reporting was a bit black and white. Well, I was already a storyteller, so she was already writing stories on her own. I think she had even gone as far to try and figure out how she could take a filmmaking class online, but, you know, that she doesn't have internet.
I reached Walla via Skype at her home in Erbid, Jordan, with the help of translator Tasneem Togoj, who was a co-facilitator of the video workshop. I asked Walla why she'd made her five-minute film.
Because I have, even when I was back in Syria, I had so many dreams and so many goals and aims that I wanted to reach, and everything just didn't feel like was enough for me. And because we live in such a closed society, it just seemed like I wasn't able to reach anywhere, especially with the people that are around me, the people that I know. They don't think the way that I think.
Walla said it's difficult for teenage refugees like her to tell the stories that haunt them. Working in video, though, offered some new options.
As a girl, I wanted to portray what was going on in the Arab world. And using this workshop, using film, I was able to show this to the people around me. However, I can't speak more about it because I don't feel comfortable.
I tried to ask Walla more questions about her film and her dreams, but she grew tense and many of her answers ended abruptly. I knew that her mother was in the room, and I asked Tasneem, our translator, to see if that was the problem.
Okay. I just asked her right now, we wanted to ask you more about your stories and stuff. And she said, I would love to tell you, but I feel like I can't speak. Yeah, she feels like she's being suffocated by her mom. That's the word she used.
And with that, our interview ended. Walla said she'd try to continue the conversation with our producer at another site. We asked our translator why Walla would feel uncomfortable answering such seemingly straightforward questions, even with family members in the room.
You're going to have to look at it from an Arab society kind of point of view. They have all these traditions, and she's just breaking all the traditions one after the other. So to them, what she's doing is not something that's worthy of what she should be doing, which is, you know, okay, study, then just get married, and that's about it. Her parents and siblings kind of give her a hard time and make her feel, you know, like she isn't worth anything because of the things that have happened to her and the things that she's done. I think that's what holds her back, is that she's afraid that they might look at her and kind of just give her more of a hard time. So dreaming big and going to America and becoming a filmmaker, it's like, what are you thinking about? No, you have to become more realistic. I think that's the only reason why she was holding back. That's not the normal thing to do. They have to stay at home and they have to get married by the time they're 14 and 15. A lot of the Syrian girls don't have these kind of dreams, and a lot of them don't really see themselves as being able to follow these dreams because nobody trusts them or nobody supports them or nobody, you know, has faith in them like Laura did.
Later that day, we did hear back from Walla. She and our producer in Jordan recorded a second conversation in a local cafe. Walla said she felt more comfortable there, speaking her mind.
We need to get rid of things like, you can't go out of the house because you're a girl. The thing that frustrates me is not just anyone who sees me and says, she's a refugee. Some people make you feel like you're one of them, but some people make you feel that you're less than them. You're just here using up our resources. Eat and sleep, and that's all. But I started to see the world through my camera, and my camera became my world. The story that prompted this film is how I used to be afraid to share with people, how I used to be afraid of my family, people, society, and how they think. I was able to overcome this fear and this barrier. I broke the barrier of fear. I would like to say to all the girls, anything that you have suppressed and are not able to let out because of customs, traditions, family, you don't want to bring shame upon the family, let it out. Talk about it. Find a way to express what's inside of you.
That 16-year-old Syrian filmmaker who uses the name Walla al-Alawi, speaking with us via translator Tasneem Togoj. Walla lives as a refugee in Erbid, Jordan. Her five-minute autobiographical film has been shown at numerous international festivals. You can see it at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's a sunny day here in Boston. Feels a bit like spring, but let's turn to a place where summer is coming to an end, Brazil, where we will spend the balance of the show now. The former president of Brazil is not having all that sunny a month. We told you last week about how Luis Ignacio da Silva, or Lula, was detained by police and brought in for questioning, part of a massive corruption probe connected to Brazil's state oil company, Petrobras. And this week, state prosecutors in Sao Paulo charged Lula with money laundering. This is huge because Lula is not just any politician. He's arguably the most popular political figure in Brazil ever. Paulo Sotero runs the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. So kind of a hero of the working class now caught up in a corruption scandal, Paulo. Could you just bring us up to speed quickly on what Lula is suspected of doing in the Petrobras investigation?
Well, he is charged of embezzling some $200,000 in a scandal that is worth maybe $3 billion. So the charge itself in monetary terms of small, but obviously his responsibility is huge because the scandal developed under his watch and the watch of President Dilma Rousseff, the successor of
Lula. Basically.
Yes, and who was also the chair of the board of Petrobras when this thing happened.
For Brazilians, how big of a deal is it that Lula, one of the most famous politicians ever, has been charged in a scandal?
We have polls this morning suggested that most Brazilians believe that he did something wrong and that obviously he should be prosecuted like anybody else. So there was a shock, though, of seeing Lula being conducted to a federal police station, and it's a major test for a 30-year-old democracy that is going through right now the second year of a deep economic recession and a crisis that was largely self-inflicted.
I'm wondering, too, politically, the fact that Lula is a standard-bearer of the left, does that shift things back to the conservatives, or have politicians of all political leanings been caught up in this?
Oh, yes. Politicians of all political leanings have been or will be caught in this. You know, the political class in Brazil is part of the problem, is a self-serving political class that has basically collapsed on top of the country, as has the economy. Brazil is not going to face a coup d'etat. The military in Brazil are not interested in that. I don't think either that we are going to go through turmoil like you can see today in Venezuela and other places.
In the long run, do you think Brazil can emerge from all these scandals and prosecutions stronger?
Oh, yes. I'm sure Brazil will, because precisely what is being advanced in Brazil today is the rule of law. We are facing an enormous dysfunctional political system. Our economic model, obviously, has exhausted itself. It's a state-oriented economic model. But institutionally, the investigation on Petrobras corruption has the support of ample majorities of the people. And even when you ask people, as we did a couple of times, considering the adverse economic impact of the investigations of the scandal, should we suspend the investigations or should we move forward? By 9 out of 10 Brazilians say, let's move forward, let's get to the bottom of this. So I think here is a positive, potentially very, very positive story with a very difficult short term.
All eyes will be on Brazil in less than 5 months with the Rio Olympics. Are these corruption scandals going to get in the way? Will they be a distraction?
Oh, certainly. You know, it will be there. There may be protests before the Olympics, etc. But, you know, do not underestimate our capacity to throw a good party, to welcome visitors. We are good at that. We like to do that. You know, we are not the only country in the world facing corruption. And I think that, you know, through a lot of hard work, we will overcome this current situation.
Paulo Sotero with the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Thanks very much for your thoughts.
Pleasure, Marco.
Finally, we want to conclude things today by remembering Brazilian musician Nana Vasconcelos. He died this week at the age of 71. He was a percussionist, but way more. He explored sounds that emerged from the indigenous heart of Brazil and wanted to find a place for those sounds in the world at large. It's possible you even know the music of Vasconcelos, you just didn't know it was him or that it was even a human making it. That's the Pat Metheny Group from a recording from the early 1980s, a collaboration with Nana Vasconcelos. Beto Arcos, who often joins us to talk music on the world, is with me. Beto, that bit in there that sounds like songbirds, that was Nana Vasconcelos. How did he do that?
He managed to create oral sonic soundscapes with percussion instruments and his voice And when you heard him, you knew it was Naná Vasconcelos. I mean, he basically took any percussion instruments, sometimes even just objects, and he would create these amazing soundscapes. He was brought to the attention of Americans in the world with the fantastic multi-instrumentalist Egiberto Gismonti in the late 70s with a record that he did with him called Danza das Cabezas in the late 70s. And this is where Vasconcelos showcased the berimbau, that amazing instrument. He was, you know, summoning all of these sounds from the forest, from Africa, through that instrument.
So there's a berimbau. I mean, Naná Vasconcelos could turn pretty much anything into a percussion instrument. And I want us to hear, too, because you mentioned this. This is a great bit of Naná Vasconcelos not so long ago in concert, where he explained in Portuguese that the first instrument we are all born with is the voice. And then he illustrates what he means. So that's Naná Vasconcelos looping himself there. If you have any doubts that the voice is not a percussion instrument, he's putting them to rest. What's going on there, Beto? What's he telling us?
Oh, he says that the first instrument is the voice. It was just genius what he was doing.
Beto, give us a recommendation of a Naná Vasconcelos track to play out today.
Well, I think that the best one to go out with is the tune that has all of those sounds of the voices. And this one is simply called Voces, or Voices.
Music writer and broadcaster Beto Arcos joining me from Los Angeles. Thanks for reminding us, Beto, of the greatness of the late Naná Vasconcelos. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for us here at The World Today. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. I'm Marco Werman in the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. We'll see you all next week.
PRI, Public Radio International.